This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Lost in the endless manufactured drivel and election shows, this planet is hot. The North barely had winter. Almost all coral in the southern hemisphere may die off this year, and heat in the world oceans stunned scientists. In this program, expert system modeler Till Kulbrot says this may be a glimpse of a future 3 degrees above pre-industrial. Are we approaching tipping points, or are some already behind us? We revisit an earlier interview on cascading tipping points as I line up guests to report the latest science just coming out. The show closes out with my few tips to survive times of mass fear. But first, let us learn more from the best about how our planetary home really works. Welcome to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Graphs of sea surface temperatures are pretty scary lately, the hottest since measurements began. Is the recent flare-up of El Niño, or is it climate change to blame? Will hot seas last, and what would that mean? New science suggests we are getting a glimpse of the future, a preview of a 3-degree hotter world. We have reached Dr. Till Kulbrot, Senior Research Fellow with the UK National Centre for Atmospheric Science. Based in the University of Reading Department of Meteorology, Dr. Kulbrot helps lead the United Kingdom Earth System Model. He is a lead author of new work on 2 major warning signs from the sea. From Reading, Dr. Kulbrot, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
I'm so glad to be here. Hi, Alex.
Well, your team's new report is on 2 changes, a hotter Atlantic and disappearing sea ice around Antarctica. First, just to begin, why is ocean heat so important, even though nobody lives there?
The one thing is that the Earth system is taking up lots of additional heat. It has been doing so since approximately 150 years or so, ever since humanity started burning fossil fuels. So there's an awful lot of additional heat in the Earth system, and we, from analysis of observational data, we know that the oceans take up about 90% of this additional heat. So this is obviously the bulk. And this means anything that's going on with the oceans warming up is a direct indication for what happens with the entire Earth system, including living beings, vegetation, and the entire atmosphere.
It seems like every day someone posts a graph showing sea surface temperatures higher than anything measured by humans before. What is the situation, and is this record warming only at the surface?
Sea surface temperature is a very good observational variable to almost do it in real time. And that is because all the weather satellites we have up there, they can basically see with their radiation the sea surface. They cannot penetrate water, but the sea surface is a very good measure. It's a very good real-time observational data. What we wrote about in this essay in BAMS is that approximately 12 months ago, the sea surface temperature of the entire North Atlantic, it kind of left everything that we have observed in the last 40 years or so, and from satellites and much longer from other data, and has become much larger than that. So really standing out by another half degree or so, which is a lot because this covers the entire Atlantic. And it has basically left the typical seasonal cycle from all the years before. And it is still there 12 months later. So it is still at a value much higher than anything before in the 40 years before. So when we started seeing that last year, we got very concerned about this because even now we don't really understand what's going on there. But the thing is the sea surface temperature, because, for instance, the winds coming across from Northern America here to us in Europe over the Atlantic, they pick up a lot of this extra heat. And this means if the sea surface of the North Atlantic is much warmer than it used to be, then that has an impact on the climate we see in Europe and in other places.
Well, you've had some pretty stormy times in Ireland and the UK and North Europe, and is that connected to this hotter North Atlantic?
It's a good question. It's always difficult to build this connection, rover's connection, for a single event. So in this paper that we wrote, we have not so much looked at individual weather patterns, but more at the large-scale picture. However, it is generally absolutely certain from our scientific understanding that with the ongoing rapid acceleration of global heating, the likelihood for extreme events in weather becomes much larger. That is something we know for sure.
You also found a mysterious change in salt levels in the North Atlantic, not seen in other parts of the world's oceans. Does this tell us something?
That is right. So one thing we're showing is that we see that the salinity in the top 100 meters in the Atlantic basin has been increasing at a rate that we don't see in other ocean basins. Currently, we don't really know what happens there. I mean, we're stating really the observations. So there could be changes in ocean currents. It could be simply changes in evaporation, which means if warmer air is over the Atlantic basin, leading to more evaporation of water, which is always pure fresh water, then that leaves behind more saline waters. It could also be there are some indications from climate model simulations that if the salinity increases in the Atlantic, separate from other ocean basins, that that could be an indication for a weakening of the Atlantic meridional overturning circulation. So at this point, we can only say this could be one of the causes. It is too early to look at the direct observations of this overturning circulation, because for that you want to have observations throughout the entire depth of the Atlantic, and those measurement devices are more there in the depths of the Atlantic. And my colleagues from Southampton here and other places need to actually literally go there, retrieve these instruments, and read out the data, which will, I think, happen later this year or early next year.
Let's go to the other end of the Earth. Several EcoShock guests report on the shocking decline of sea ice around Antarctica. What is going on, and why did you choose that as a focus point in your new study?
Yeah, so in Antarctica, or in the waters around Antarctica in the Southern Ocean, it has been observed since approximately 2015 that, as opposed to decades before, the sea ice cover is rapidly going down. We have looked there, actually, because when we saw this very, very, very extremely warm sea surface temperature in the North Atlantic, my idea was to look at a global context. I mean, there will be local processes as well leading to this very warm surface, but I wanted to see what's going on in the other ocean basins. And now if you go from the Atlantic of the latitudes of North America or Europe and you go all the way down, then you see that there's a basin called Weddell Sea, which is part of the Southern Ocean and also part of deep water formation size and a climatically very active part of the Southern Ocean. So I was looking for global connections there. And then sea ice cover is like sea surface temperature is something that the satellites can see very easily. It's an indicator that is available in real time. And so I just looked at that, and then I was intrigued by the fact that we just see this similarity or the same thing happening. The North Atlantic becoming extremely warm out of a sudden compared to 40 years before, and then the Southern Ocean did the same with the sea ice extent. This could be coincidence, of course, but I would love to be sure that it's coincidence and exclude major changes in global ocean circulation as an underlying reason.
Well, naturally, people on the east coast of the Americas and in Northern Europe worry about a change in the Gulf Stream, and that keeps people warm. But Australian scientist Matthew England told us the other end of that ocean heat pump, the Antarctic bottom circulation, has already begun an unstoppable weakening. Is there a connection between these two great current systems? What are your thoughts?
That is a good question. I mean, that is a question that people like me and others have been thinking about and doing research on for decades, actually. What is certainly true is that in the Southern Ocean, approximately at the latitudes of the tip of South America, there is a belt of very, very strong westerly winds that lead to a large-scale upwelling of deep water masses. So you can imagine the wind is pushing the waters apart and a lot of waters are welling up. And some of these waters go northwards into the Atlantic and down well there in the around Greenland. And part of the same waters are being pushed towards the Antarctic coast, and then they form this Antarctic bottom water. So there is certainly a link between these two overturning circulations. How strong it is, and that is something that we don't understand very well, and we couldn't really quantify it, but we always think of it as one connected system.
Former NASA scientist James Hansen insists the key measurement for the state of the Earth is not carbon dioxide, but the difference between arriving solar energy and heat reflected back into space. Tell us about Earth energy imbalance and its disturbing recent trends.
On that point, I would fully agree with Jim Hansen. This Earth energy imbalance is exactly as you said. It's basically it's outgoing minus incoming, or the other way around, depending on how you define it. This difference tells you how much heat the Earth system is actually taking up. And when we began the interview, I was talking about that. For, let's say, for the first 20 years of this century, 2000-2020, this imbalance was had values like something 0.7, 0.8 watts per square meter. That sounds small, but it's per square meter. And obviously, if you multiply this with the surface of the Earth, it's a very large value. Now, again, from satellite data, we have seen that since about 10 or 15 years, approximately, this Earth energy imbalance has developed a steep upward trend. So this value at the top of the atmosphere becomes larger from year to year. So currently, we are at values in the region of 1.5 watts per square meter for the past 12 months, for instance. And this is really quite concerning because this is clearly evidence for the acceleration of global heating. So not only do we see that the Earth system is warming up from year to year, but the amount by which it warms up is also increasing by year to year. And that is very, very concerning indeed. So there are various possible reasons certainly reasons is the ever-increasing concentration of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, the vast majority of that from human action. Also, the reduction of aerosol emissions, soot particles, for instance, sulfur particles who would reflect sunlight. The thing with these aerosol emissions is, however, that they come with very large uncertainties. We cannot observe them very well. So that contribution is not quite clear at the moment. But this acceleration that it has also been proven from other data, so from direct observations of temperature in the ocean waters, you can also show that it has been shown convincingly. Yeah, that is extremely concerning because if you extrapolate this acceleration for the next 20, 30 years, we will be quickly going into regions with our climate system which become very, very inhospitable for us humans and most of other animals and the vegetation.
The paper published in the Bulletin of the American Meteorological Society promises glimpses into the future in a hotter world. What do you mean?
The idea was here that we have seen in 2023 these extremes, far out extremes in sea surface temperature for the North Atlantic and sea ice cover for the Southern Ocean. And we were thinking, well, we know that the climate system as a whole, or the Earth system, goes into this direction anyway. So we thought, at what global warming level in the future would we expect such extremes to be the new normal, basically? And so we looked at a great number of climate model simulations and Earth system model simulations, which are available in archives, those archives which are being used for these assessment reports of the IPCC. So this is really an illustrative exercise, but we found that if you look at the mean climate state at a 3-degree global warming level, so for context, currently we are at approximately 1.2 degrees of global warming on average. And what we found is that these very high sea surface temperatures in the North Atlantic, which we have observed this 1 year so far, and the very low sea ice extent in the Southern Ocean, this is what we would expect to be the average conditions if we go towards a 3-degree global warming. And this really serves as an illustration what we're up to if we go that high as a humanity. Because in the North Atlantic and in the Northern Hemisphere as a whole, obviously in 2023, we have seen a lot of extreme climatic extreme events that have caused a lot of damage, that have caused a lot of deaths in some events. We would have that every year at approximately a 3-degree global warming level.
You hold a senior role at the United Kingdom Earth Systems Model. You are co-author of several papers on Earth model development. What is an Earth system model? Does it exist on a computer network in one place? And why is the United Kingdom funding and working hard on this?
So an Earth system model in general is something very similar to a global climate model. So global climate models have been around for 40 years now, approximately. Don't quote me on that. Could also be 30 or 50, depending on your definition. This is kind of like a huge amount of code, numerical computer code that calculates how the circulation in the ocean and in the atmosphere is going to develop over the next decades ahead. So this has been long around for just the ocean and the atmosphere and a little bit of the land surface and ice cover. If you upgrade this basically into an Earth system model, then you include a lot of chemistry. So for the atmosphere, that would be the whole chemistry of the ozone layer. It would be all the aerosols from humans, for instance, sulfur particles again, and how these are chemically processed. For the ocean, it includes the carbon cycle. So the oceans play an equally important role for processing all the additional carbon in the atmosphere from the carbon dioxide emissions. And so there's a lot of chemistry. So basically, we include all the chemistry of the Earth system. And specifically for the UK Earth system model, we are also including the dynamical ice sheets. So not only the sea ice cover on the Arctic and the Antarctic, which is usually relatively thin, a few meters maximum, but also the very slowly moving mile-high ice cover on Antarctica and Greenland. So the idea is that you have a computer model that is as comprehensive as we can for all the components of the Earth system. So this is, in our case, approximately 1 million lines of computer code, which we can run as a whole on modern top-tier supercomputers. So in our case, we do it at the UK Met Office and at other computing centers here in the UK, which are accessible to universities.
We repeatedly get news stories about climate-driven extremes beyond model projections. Some scientists complain the big models are too conservative, which may lead governments to underestimate the climate challenge. What do you think?
This is a very important point from my point of view. And this is one of the main conclusions of this paper in BAMS that we published a few weeks ago, that we say we do see evidence that some of these extreme events we have observed in the past few years are not captured by the models. And one example is the extreme warming that was seen in the northwestern states of the United States and on the west coast of Canada. I think that was approximately 2 years ago. So we really need to very carefully evaluate all these models, Earth system models, for instance, to make sure that we capture these extremes, because obviously people need warning, communities want to adapt to that. And that is an extremely important task, which we urgently need to do, because these things are happening now and people need information now. How likely are extreme events in the region, in the area where I live?
Can the UK Earth system model include things like tipping points?
We are looking into that. So I'm not doing that personally, but there are quite a few people that work with me on the UK Earth system model who are involved in a big project. This is currently funded by the European Union, by the Commission, on tipping points in Earth system models. So it could be sudden changes in the ocean circulation. It could be rapidly retreating ice sheet cover. It could be irreversible cover of vegetation, things like that. So this is a very, very active study of research, absolutely.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock from the University of Reading. Our guest is Earth System Model expert Till Kulbrot. We are talking about hot warning signs from the ocean pole to pole. I am fascinated by long-distance relationships on this planet, like teleconnections and big global waves. The new paper explores, quote, signs for connection between the North Atlantic and the Southern Ocean extremes, end quote. Please talk to us about what connections you can find between the poles.
So what we see, I mean, this is kind of like a very first glimpse on that, really. But what we see is that approximately around the year 2016, we have seen that the whole of the Atlantic has been showing a stronger warming trend than the other ocean basins. It has also been well documented that the year 2016 has also seen a major regime change in the Southern Ocean. And that is that between 1979, when satellite observation started, and 2016, on average, the sea ice cover there increased, which is counterintuitive in a warming world, but this is what we observed. By the way, a feature that the climate models never captured properly. And then around 2016, something happened in the Southern Ocean. Ever since then, the sea ice cover is decreasing rapidly. And so I see I have found now these signs in the ocean in the top 100 meters or 150 meters in the whole Atlantic basin warming up. And so this made me wonder, and so far I cannot do much more than pointing this out, that this is a very puzzling question, whether there's a link between the sea ice loss in the Southern Ocean, which of course has to go along with warming, and the warming in the Atlantic basin. So whether there's some sort of overall regime change there going on. So far, it's a big question for me, and definitely more work needs to be done to find out what the actual driving processes there are.
Dr. Kuhlbrot, longer-term impacts of climate change is one of your specialties. Do you expect warming and related changes will develop in a gradual, perhaps predictable ramp up over decades, or could the climate shift in steps with big changes and then pauses at a sort of new level of normal? What do you think?
That's a very good question. I mean, if we look at how climate has warmed up globally and in over the past, let's say, 40, 50 years, we have not seen big jumps there, really. I mean, there are sometimes smaller jumps in some regions, but overall, it has been relatively smooth. That doesn't necessarily mean that the next decades are going to be smooth as well. Of course, there could be these tipping points ahead. I don't think we are certain about this in any regard. The most important thing I can say is that, I mean, what happens in the future, although, of course, depends absolutely crucially on what we as the human community keep emitting into the atmosphere. Or put it in another way, the less greenhouse gases we keep emitting into the atmosphere, the less trigger is there for larger jumps if they are ahead. And the more we limit the damage and mitigate the detrimental impact. So, because this uncertainty is out there, this is reason enough, in my understanding, to say, well, if we know that there's uncertainty out there and even a small risk for a major jump, then we most certainly don't want to go there. You know, it's the most basic precautionary thinking that we say, let's stay away from that, curb emissions as much as we can, even if it hurts, to avoid these major risks.
But as we speak, pretty well every oil and gas corporation and country is committing to more, not less, fossil fuels. The U.S. shot up to number one producer. The U.K. approved more drilling. Canada's building pipelines, on and on. When you produce future scenarios for your models, do you include a high emissions future, and what might that look like?
Absolutely. This is to produce the scenarios for assumed development of human emissions in the next 40, 50, 60 years. That's a big globally coordinated effort between lots of different scientific disciplines. There are scenarios that say, okay, we keep emitting fossil fuels as much as we can. There are scenarios where we say humanity becomes reasonable and reduces it a lot. There are scenarios which are called regional rivalry, so where we say kind of like there's a lot of conflict going on, a lot of warfare, and people just don't have it on top of their heads to reduce emissions because there's much more urgent things to deal with. And so these scenarios over the next 10, 20, 30 years are diverging quite wildly. if we keep emitting fossil fuels, no matter what, then it's pretty clear that in 20 years from now, it's not going to be come stepwise, but I mean, years like we have seen in 2023 for the Northern Hemisphere with crazy extreme events, with precipitation events that kill thousands of inhabitants of cities overnight, like we have seen it in the Mediterranean, much more weather variability, so much longer droughts, much stronger precipitation events, rain, or it could be in Northern America, there's often snowstorms, of course. So it would become much more inhospitable. We would also embark on a road of accelerated rates of sea level rise. And that's something that cannot be returned. So we already have banked in a large amount of sea level rise. And if you think of major world cities that are built right at the water's edge, New York is, of course, an example. Places like large port towns in Europe, like Hamburg, for instance, or Barcelona, would basically be submerged, if not in my lifetime, but then in the lifetime of one or two generations after us. And, of course, this is something you don't want to leave as a curse on generations after you.
So when we finish this interview and you go back to work, what are you working on now?
Currently, actually, we are looking at, we have run a big ensemble, so a big number of simulations with our Earth system model, where we look more than 100 or 150 years into the future, and we look at what happens if we keep emitting as we are, but not for much longer, and then the emissions of carbon or greenhouse gases go to zero, and then maybe even we can, in 50, 100 years from now, we have developed very good technology to get rid of a lot of the carbon in the atmosphere. So this would mean we can actually manage to cool down the climate again. And we are currently looking at these simulations to understand what's going on there, what of the effects of a hot climate can be reversed, what other effects we cannot maybe reverse, and to have more understanding of the options that we have as a humanity looking forward for the next two or three generations.
From the University of Reading Department of Meteorology, we've been speaking with Dr. Till Coolbrot. He's the Senior Research Fellow with the UK National Centre for Atmospheric Science. We've been discussing the new paper, A Glimpse into the Future, the 2023 Ocean Temperature and Sea Ice Extremes in the Context of Longer-Term Climate Change. That is open access, free to read. Find links to follow up in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Till, thank you for sharing your valuable time with us.
Yeah, thank you so much, Alex. It was a pleasure talking to you. A very interesting conversation that we had there. Very relevant.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
As I work out guests for a new Tipping Point report, we should refresh with this foundational interview with Dr. Tim Lenton from the University of Exeter. Lenton is a leader in this field, working with top scientists and other institutions like the Potsdam Institute and the Stockholm Resilience Center. This will bring us up to speed on tipping points. With climate, the worst-case scenario is not a risk anyone can accept. I think you know that. Disaster, some say, is not unlikely, and it may not even be far away. We may already be headed to a hothouse world, and if so, perhaps all we can hope is to slow down that wrenching change. Those are the kind of dark considerations of some very highly regarded scientists. In November, just days before the Madrid COP25 climate conference, this group published a comment in the top journal Nature. It is titled, Climate Tipping Points, Too Risky to Bet Against. From the University of Exeter, UK, we have reached the lead author, Professor Timothy M. Lenton, director of the Global Systems Institute. Tim Lenton, a warm welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me.
So we call the new age the Anthropocene, but is that a new steady state where we will all be comfortable, or is it a whirlwind of change?
I think the Anthropocene is best described as the latter, a time of, at the moment, continual change, and indeed perhaps a whirlwind of change. It's certainly not a stable state. We're clearly in a transition at the moment. And I guess the question is, what to?
Well, to get a grip on this huge subject, I broke your concerns down into three major categories. I want to run them by you and see if we can talk about these. And so they are, number one, tipping points in unique systems, like, say, the Amazon. And number two, long-distant impacts in a chain of events following a tipping point. And then three, the global cascade, a domino effect of tipping points interacting. Does that sound like a reasonable framework for our chat?
Absolutely, yeah.
So, your comment in Nature begins with tipping points, but it doesn't end there. But to be sure we are all on board here, Tim Lenton, how do you describe a tipping point?
Well, I like to use the common example of an ordinary chair to explain to people that the world is full of systems that have different stable states. And in the case of the chair, chair upright is a stable state, but chair lying on its back is also a stable state. And if you're leaning back on the chair, you get to a point where a little bit of a nudge one way or the other is going to determine whether you're back upright or lying flat on your back. And that's the kind of tipping point in the simple case of a chair. There are lots of parts of the Earth's climate system that are a whole lot more complex than chairs, but can also exhibit different stable states and tipping points between them. So an example might be the Greenland ice sheet, where if you were to take it away under today's climate, it wouldn't regrow. And the thing that's allowing it to persist is that it's stuck 3 kilometres up in the air and the temperature's much colder up there, so that keeps the surface cold and enables the ice sheet to persist. But at some point, as you warm the ice sheet up and it starts to melt and the surface drops in altitude and that warms things up further, at some point that process that's self-amplifying becomes self-propelling and you reach a tipping point where you'd lose that ice sheet altogether. So that's one of several examples in the climate.
Yes, has the Amazon rainforest gone past a tipping point?
Let's hope not. I think at some smaller scales, we might say that the Amazon is showing signs of getting tipped, especially in the drier southeast part of the Amazon, where it's not just that people are chopping the forest down, but the recent extreme drought summers that have hit the Amazon have led to a change in fire regimes so that sometimes we're seeing bits of the forest transition away from forest to something more like a savanna. For the bulk of the forest, it's not tipped yet, but we know that the Amazon forest recycles its own rainfall, and that's the way in which it kind of sustains itself. But if you take out too many of the trees, especially in the wrong place, then you would kind of shut off that water recycling system, and that could doom the rest of the forest on a larger scale.
Could whole regions go past a tipping point, but we don't know it yet, even in science, so we only see them in a rear-view mirror?
Well, this is a potential problem with ice sheets and with any system that is naturally sluggish or slow. If you think about ice, it flows very, very slowly, and there's a huge bulk of ice both on Greenland, West Antarctica, and particularly East Antarctica. We think we see evidence in part of West Antarctica and a small part of East Antarctica that the ice sheets there are being destabilized. They're undergoing an accelerating retreat of glaciers. But because that's quite a sluggish system, that at the rate it's going at the moment, it will still take thousands of years, happily, for it to unfold, for the complete loss of something like the West Antarctic ice sheet. But this gets worse as the temperature goes up. So the more we warm the climate, the quicker things can unfold.
Your group, which I note includes my hero, Hans Schellenhuber, then proposes...
Yeah.
It's a great group, a lot from the Potsdam Institute and so on. They propose a long-distance impact in a chain of events following a tipping point. And I think the one that came clearest to me in your article, it would be a change in the North Atlantic current. Could you talk to us about how something that happens in one part of the Earth could affect the whole globe, possibly?
Absolutely. The crucial thing here is that the Earth and its climate is a complex but interconnected system. So what we begin to see in terms of accelerating change in the world is we see the Arctic warming up far faster than the global average, partly because the sea ice is melting, exposing a darker ocean surface that's absorbing more heat. And that amplified warming in the Arctic is contributing to the melt of the Greenland ice sheet that's also accelerating. That's adding fresh water into the North Atlantic Ocean either side of Greenland. And those are exactly the regions where deep water forms. Water from goes right from the surface of the Atlantic Ocean to the very bottom. And that's a crucial part of propelling what we call the overturning circulation of the Atlantic, that includes massive surface currents of the ocean transporting heat from the southern hemisphere to the northern hemisphere and then across in the Gulf Stream, across the Atlantic Ocean. And that's weakening that circulation, partly because of extra fresh water coming in to the North Atlantic region. And we know from the Earth's climate past, the record of that, that when you weaken that circulation, it drags the whole band of rainfall around the tropics of the planet a little bit southwards because there's less of this heat transport by the ocean. And that in turn can disrupt monsoons in West Africa, in South America where the Amazon is, around the planet in India. And when you weaken the heat transport from the south to the north, you also leave more of the heat behind in the southern ocean. And that can contribute to the melting of the ice sheets around Antarctica. So it's in that kind of physical way, through the transport of heat, moisture, momentum, that the oceans, the atmosphere, couple the planet together.
Now, is that what you mean by a global cascade? Because that sounds so risky. It's as final almost as a thermonuclear war. If we get one tipping point causing other tipping points and it just goes out of control, is that what you're discussing in the paper?
Well, we're raising the possibility that there can be that the causal connections and interactions between what I call the tipping elements in the climate can be wired up in a way where one thing increases the likelihood of tipping another. And that does seem to be the kind of causality that I just described in the example I gave. It would require some special conditions for this to become a runaway process, like tipping the proverbial dominoes. It needs the coupling to be quite strong for tipping one thing to force the tipping of the next. But it seems to be, we think, a legitimate concern, and obviously something that we should assess carefully to get a proper handle on the amount of risk we're running with climate change. And we're particularly interested in this because we look in Earth's past and we see times when the planet was much hotter than today, with unusual temperature gradient between the equator and the pole and so on. And models that we have to model today's climate, they really struggle to reproduce these past what we'd call hothouse Earth states. But we know they existed, so we have a suspicion that there are either some of these tipping cascades or some other very strong feedbacks in the climate that can propel the whole Earth to go into a hotter state. We've got to try and avoid that, if that's possible, to occur.
Definitely. I'd like to go back to your 2018 paper that you co-authored, Trajectories of the Earth System in the Anthropocene. Just a really groundbreaking shake-up paper. In Figure 2 of that paper, it shows two possible futures for us. One is labeled Stabilized Earth, and the other is Hothouse Earth. It almost sounds in this new paper that we may have to give up on stabilized Earth, and our best hope is just to slow down our fall, drag it out as long as possible, heading towards hothouse Earth. Is that the way people are feeling these days?
Maybe one or two people are feeling it's that bleak. My personal view is we've still got a lot to play for, and there's still a chance we can create a stabilized Earth, but we might, at least in temperature terms, that ought to still be possible and should be something to aim for. What's unclear at the moment is whether we've made a commitment for a wet house Earth, a higher sea level, basically, because we may have already tipped the loss of some big ice sheets, even if it's unfolding slowly over thousands of years. So it might be possible to reverse that, because these ice sheets are melting slowly. We'd obviously have to keep things cool if we wanted to try and reverse it. So, yeah, where I'm at with it is we've got a chance to still to create a stabilized Earth, but we've got some clearly got some work to do to achieve that. We might still be in a situation where some of the sea level rise, albeit coming slowly, has got a certain inevitability about it. I don't think we'd be wise to sort of vote for going through one of those incredible sort of convulsions of the planet. It would be a very, very risky place to be. And that's, I guess, the kind of risks I'm trying to articulate with this latest paper. But I believe that there's still the opportunity to build, create, make a much better, brighter, more sustainable future, which has obviously got to be powered by sustainable energy sources, and it's got to be based on recycling all the materials we need to make new stuff out of the old stuff we have, just as the biosphere does. And I guess that's the kind of stark or interesting choice we've presented ourselves with now. I don't think anyone would want to voluntarily go for the climate apocalypse, but if we don't change the trajectory we're on, I'm afraid that's where we're heading. And yeah, my other work is about saying, okay, we're not going to retreat either, I don't think, in the sense of we're not going to lower global energy consumption. Well, there's no sign of that. So instead, we need a kind of way through this that's towards a sustainable energy, material recycling, flourishing future for people that doesn't wreck the planet.
And then there's a paper published in PNAS in 2008, and it showed systems can appear to reach an equilibrium just before they break into a significant change of state. You and your co-author Chris Bolton wrote about that in 2015. I interviewed Chris on Radio EcoShock. So that's really another trap. Things can look very stable, just nice and calm, and then they shift radically and they never go back. That makes it hard to communicate the risks. I mean, it seems like everything's going okay right now, but it could turn bad quickly.
I know there's a certain irony in the fact that that a complex system can actually become more sluggish in response to all the nudges it's getting from the world before it undergoes a really dramatic tipping point kind of change. It can be made to seem intuitive if it's possible to understand that any system with these different stable states has these mechanisms that we call feedbacks that, by definition, if it has a stable state, try to drag it back to whatever that preferred state is. But when we're seeing a system heading towards a tipping point, we're essentially seeing those stabilizing mechanisms starting to break down and get weaker. And that's why, as you're heading towards a tipping point, when you nudge a system, it actually recovers more slowly from the nudges you're giving it. And that's a signal we've successfully looked for in some past cases of approaches to abrupt climate change, for example. But it is, like all of this science of complex systems and ones involving the biosphere as well, it is inherently sometimes a little counterintuitive and interesting how these things behave. And that's, I guess, how people like me can make their living, spending 25 years of their life trying to grapple with this sometimes unintuitive complexity and then try and explain it to everybody else.
Well, it's amazing that apes can get into their brains how the whole universe works or even try to do something like that, but we do.
We do, yeah.
Yeah. How big, Tim, do you think our remaining carbon budget is before we cross tipping points?
Well, I fear that we might have crossed one or two in the ice sheets, and we're just not absolutely sure about that because it's not super easy to observe the slow dynamics unfolding in inhospitable places of the world, like around the edges of Antarctica. So we might be at a tipping point for some triggering some slow ice sheet losses. I hope we're not. But if that's not the case, I think we're really running into dangerous territory if we're going towards 1.5 degrees of global warming from the current 1 degree and a bit in centigrade, that is. And the remaining budget to stay within, to try and limit the warming to 1.5 degrees, it's maybe around 400, possibly 500 billion tons of CO2. But that budget's probably being eaten away at by the fact that we're triggering some tipping point loss of carbon.
Well, like you, I think the rate of change may be the key. It may be the thing that we can control and our best hope. It would be great if we could slow this shift down enough to allow natural selection and evolution to help transition the species, but at our current rate, that doesn't seem like that time will be there. What do you think?
Well, certainly not for natural selection in the sense of based on genetics and population genetics. That's generally pretty slow. In the human realm, of course, we have something else which we loosely call cultural evolution. It's clear that humans are evolving far faster than evolution purely based on genetics. And instead, cultural evolution probably took hold thousands of years ago and is absolutely dominating now. And that what I mean by that is we have these different symbolic forms and language forms in which we communicate information, and we sometimes imitate each other's behaviors, and so on and so forth. So we'd like to comfort ourselves, I think, that we're a pretty adaptable species, partly because we have this cultural evolution. But of course, it's the same cultural evolution in the form of the Industrial Revolution and everything else that's been driving the problem. And we can't deny at the same time that we're biological beings, and we've got some physiological limits to what we can tolerate. So simple things like our temperature tolerance is not going to magically evolve. And we see a real risk in these climate change model scenarios that large parts of the planet start to get to temperatures that become pretty physiologically intolerable in parts of the years in heat waves for all mammals, including humans. So, yeah, there's some basic biological constraints we're not going to evolve our way out of. But maybe there's some hope if we can perhaps change the way we're culturally evolving.
And where does your work go from here, Tim?
Well, I would really like to focus a bit more of my energy on how can we tip positive change to avoid the really bad climate tipping points. I think the problem for someone like me, trained as a scientist, as an environmental scientist, is we're so used to diagnosing the problem, and we're getting spectacularly good at diagnosing the problem and telling everybody else about it. But what the world's crying out for now, I think, is probably a roadmap of the solutions. And how are we going to transform ourselves into a flourishing, sustainable future? So I'm trying to spend some energy now identifying where are the possible positive tipping points to tip that transformation that we know we need to a sustainable future. Where can we find those, and how might we activate them? I have to say I'm having to learn a lot along the way, but that's the joy of being an academic, is you get a kick out of learning new things and thinking about new problems.
We have been speaking with UK professor and director of Global Systems Institute at Exeter, Dr. Tim Lenton. The paper, Climate Tipping Points, Too Risky to Bet Against, is available free. You could just Google that, or you can look in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Tim, thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
Well, thanks for the insightful questions and getting me onto all the interesting territory. That was great.
That was a refresher interview from Radio EcoShock, broadcast January 8th, 2020. It may have been edited for length. 4 years on, a new report on global tipping points is out, and we will go there soon. Maybe you will need this. Are you afraid? Lots of people are trying to evaluate the appropriate level of panic, whether to check supplies in the bunker, run away, or just pull up the covers and hide. I have thoughts, starting with a story. I did not know there was a revolution on both land and sea around 100 million years ago. The marine revolution reminds me of medieval castle building. The stone defenses became thicker and more intricate in castles until more powerful cannon arrived. Then castles became expensive holdovers, no match for new war methods. For hundreds of millions of years, many ocean creatures built protective calcium shells, like castle walls. Then, in a period when continents were moving and climate changed the sea levels, two new types of species appeared. One had jaws that could crunch shells. The others were worm-like creatures which could eat or dissolve small holes in the shells and then enter through those breaches to devour the interior. Whole orders of creatures, including the brachiopods I collected as fossils as a kid, were wiped out. On land, between 150 million years ago, again believed to be due to climate change, flowering plants appeared in a terrestrial revolution. It was a wild time of creation of new shapes and colors. Flowering plants decorated this planet. Their arrival also drove development of new predators, and it prodded evolution of coexisting creatures like ants. A crazy number of ant species comes from that same time. I'm sure there is something deep in all that. My whole life, and all human life, have been living on the edge of utter disaster since the development of nuclear weapons deliverable by missiles or bombers. One big flash, everything goes quiet, and dark nuclear winter sets in for 8 to 10 years. Whatever survives begins again. Humanity suffered mass fears, real and imagined, as long as we have written records. One foundational source of multiple threats is the Hebrew Bible, and the three religions believing in it, the people of the book. God sends floods, fires, pestilence, plagues. God approves his people committing genocide on others in the land of Canaan. Through thousands of years, the most settled people and seemingly powerful empires experienced a sudden arrival of hostile armies bent on looting and killing. Some attackers destroyed the cities of their victims and burned whatever could burn. The Mongols come to mind. During the late 1100s and 1200 CE, a relative warming developed in Europe, part of long-term natural cycles. With better weather and thus improved crop yields, population increased. Then, in the middle of the 1300s, the Black Plague arrived. Conservative estimates find over half the population of Europe died. COVID, deadly and crippling as it is not as bad as the plague, which struck before any conceptions of science and modern medicine. Therefore, it is realistic and well-founded to sense the fragility of life. But that helpful evolutionary trait can attack societies and the mind like an autoimmune disease. History is filled with episodes of mass fear based on rational fears that did not happen. Some fast-spreading panics were based on mass delusion, difficult for the modern mind to comprehend. European Christians were instructed to prepare for the end times any day when Jesus returns to fight epic battles with the devil. They promised most of humanity will be wiped out. These teachings were deeply embedded since earliest childhood and reinforced weekly, if not daily. Periodically, masses of poor people walked away from their homes in search of a miracle or a crusade or just to wait for the Messiah. They died or were enslaved. Call it superstition, but it survives well in modern minds and societies. This long-standing, culturally inbred mass fear is used daily by Western news media, movies, and more. All that big fear goes on high-speed overdrive through telephones and social media. We've never seen anything like it for the fast communication of fear. The most frightening videos, blogs, and podcasts are rewarded by actual views and by advertising-driven algorithms. Be aware, built-in mass fear is being stimulated and used against you. Be suspicious of the next rumor that collapse is coming tomorrow. Whether you choose to let that panic survival network that's developed in your brain kick in, when and how much, it is still a choice for most people. A few people may not be able to control the fear. Complicating the great fear, there is a tendency to confuse our own sense of unavoidable death and widespread death for others. We think the world ends when we do. We find this especially in older men and less in women. Some older men specialize in preaching doom, the kind of hell that will appear either soon or on a predicted date. They may claim a vision or signs, whether religious or not. The end times they preach is more likely their own end, their own under-acknowledged sense of mortality. While mass mortality events are possible, maybe even getting more probable, no one knows the future for sure, or at least in detail. This universe and life in it takes surprising twists You've seen it. Anyone with a true vision of the future is deluded and may want you to share that delusion. Be open to the idea that the future is an open system. That may not save you or people around you. The open future may be another terrestrial revolution where long-known species disappear and unsuspected life forms triumph. Perhaps comforting and helpful for orientation, time is relative for each of us. For seniors, the wrenching collapse in New World Order is unlikely to come in their few remaining years. And if it does come, and I must starve, I will, without great regrets. My life has been rich, more than all humans before me could have expected. The sadness and fear I feel for my kids and grandchildren needs to be limited, and when I can, I redirect it into action, however useless or small it may seem. Why waste time and mental energy on despair? Why run away from remaining life? We can keep growing in understanding, in gifting, in art. New secrets of deep time and space are offered to us daily. Learn anything, learn everything. As you explore the birth of flowering plants 100 million years ago, or the birth in all living things now, something in your core feels joy. It is permissible to feel joy, even in the darkest days. As Holocaust survivor Viktor Frankl explained in his book, Man's Search for Meaning, there were marriages celebrated in the death camps. Personal growth and happiness can repel mass fear and despair if you let it. Enjoy yourself, even if it is later than you think. That is how I try to survive, despite knowing what I know. Let happiness, or at least contentment, bloom in your heart and mind for part of every day. Celebrate small things and occasions. Pass on a little love, or at least understanding and empathy. Help someone or something. Find living nature daily if possible. Look at the sky, spend time under it. Notice and nurture pleasure and good moments. If you are lost in memories, choose good destinations for your mind travel, not trauma and mistakes. Life is ludicrous and wild. Laugh. Next week, I will bring you more expert voices explaining humanity and life as we know it are in deeper trouble. Efforts and chances to save ourselves are tiny, but not non-existent. If you cannot handle it, maybe tune out for a while, disconnect and go outside, breathe deep, and then try again. Along the way in this radio journey, we also recover millions of years of lost memory of this planet. We acquire new amazement at the working of this planetary home, and yes, we talk with the continuing genius of humans. Amid warnings of dark death technologies, new ways of life and life-saving methods are also flocking into time. These are exciting times to be alive. Cherish them. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.